that, you know, it's like how kids talk about baseball players. That's how we talk about albums.
We're just trying to postpone mortality.
They need that to fill some kind of void that they have.
The search for the Yeti.
He's a duck.
Well, don't interrupt.
Welcome back to the Smashing Pumpcast. I'm Frank Garcia Hale.
I am Pat O'Brien, and we are back with our third and final installment of our Machina 2 EP coverage, and actually the conclusion of our long, crazy, hot, sticky Machina summer. So this episode, we're going to be talking about EP 3, CR-03.
Enjoy.
And we will hope and pray for that reissue to come out. We will pray to God. That is, if there is a God.
If there's a God, I know he likes to rock. He likes his loud guitars and the spiders from my.
A God, piano in voice or piano slash vox version, has alternate lyrics, which are barely different. There's maybe an added word or a line or two, but it's really like pretty much the same song,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, as the Machina 2 version of it, but it's all piano-y.
Yeah, definitely lends itself to the musical. This is like the Dark Night of the Soul, following the Dark Night of the Soul in the musical, just solo, you know, Billy at the piano. Cape, you know.
Yeah, I feel that this fits. That's actually funny that you say that, because it reminds me of like Cotillion's. Like, it does have that feel of like, yeah, when we saw him do that solo show,
uh-huh,
you know, back at the lodge room. It does have that feel to it,
mm-hmm,
and I think it fits into your play theory, Pat. Like, you know, this one especially, that we're talking about how like callbacks and stuff,
totally,
and,
yeah,
and reprises and whatnot. But Alan, what is your thought? What are your thoughts on this track?
Well, obviously, you know, Spiders from Mars, we've got a Ziggy Stardust reference in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have a feel that's sort of similar, if less grand than Life on Mars.
Right.
And I would say this about this version of the song. I really do love this song. But at the same time, I also like the full band version as well. And I kind of wish that we had something that met in the middle, like a third version that was piano and vocals and then built up to, mm-hmm, the full band version.
Oh, yeah. Guns N' Roses style almost.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Use Your Illusion era, like for real.
Yeah.
Like, I think they work as separate songs, but I think they would work better if they were married in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that this song had the potential to be huge for them, for the simple fact that I remember Billy doing a solo acoustic show for one of the K-Rock Acoustic Christmases, and he played this, and the fan response, like the audience response, was really good. And I remember being really moved, you know, emotionally by the lyrics, by that earnestness behind the words, and everything we've been talking about, the 70s rock worship and all that stuff. I feel like this is the culmination of like, well, I've seen, I've come, I've conquered, but this is the reflection, mm-hmm, of like, but where do I go now? Which is so inherent to the Glass storyline. And what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode was Slow Dawn and that parting line in that song. So at the end of the day, I think this is a really beautiful song. Billy and a piano obviously has shown up in a lot of different forms, especially with his solo work more recently. But I think this is one of the best Billy and a piano solo like songs.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and I'm not sure if Mike Garson is on here at all, because there isn't really any lead piano work. but it does. Right. It is very evocative of his type of playing too.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mention that, because that track in Slow Dawn, because these tracks were particularly used in the background quite a bit of the animated, Glass animated series for the three episodes that are actually up online.
Mm-hmm. So much of my Pumpkins thinking is like the old fan initialisms and acronyms. So anytime I think of that cartoon, I think of Gottmog. That's what pops in my head. Gottmog.
Gottmog. Yeah, I think this song to me just kind of proves that he's a pure musician, and it's incredible when you think about like this at its bones, and it's, you know, at its bare bones, and then the other version of it. Yeah. How like he's so good at just crafting a song from an acoustic or piano, mm-hmm. and then building out like all the Seer songs, especially.
Yeah,
I can't wait to hear those songs live. Apparently, in the September shows they're going to be playing a few of those Seer songs live, and apparently like the acoustic demos of those songs too are like incredible, and they sound mm-hmm. completely different. So it's going to be really cool to hear. I don't know. I just really love doing this podcast, really has, and listening to these demos and stuff. You're like, oh, it just starts with such a simple song structure. Yeah. And the way that he builds it out and the way that he arranges it is just incredible.
Totally. Yeah. And I think if we were to see, I think this song performed live would beg for kind of what you were talking about, Alan, like Absolutely. The middle ground version where you start with just the voice and piano and kind of build it out, you know, as the performance progresses.
It should have like the ending of a like have the same feeling of Kiss's God Gave Rock and Roll.
Because that's what the song is aiming at anyway. It's sort of a love letter to those bands and that style of songwriting, whether we're talking about Bowie or Kiss or Queen, like it does have, or even GNR, you know, like it mm-hmm. does have that sort of vibe. It's just a big rock ballad, you know, but even like you were saying, Frank, like even at this sort of almost infancy version of it, it's still, I mean, even down to the sustain of the piano and everything, it builds an atmosphere. You know, and it's just pretty. Although part of me, you know, thinks about the cynicism of this period, and Billy's like, anything I can do, you can do, I can do better mantra. I'm wondering if this is also a response to Joan Osborne's What If God Was One of Us? I've always thought about
totally.
That.
Totally. It's kind of, it's asking the same questions, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
I did jury duty with her once.
No way. Really?
What, really?
Yeah, jury duty with Joan Osborne.
Wow.
Very
that's
nice.
Cool.
Well, any final thoughts on if there is a God piano version?
I don't know if there's a piano version of God.
That would be cool, though.
You get up to the pearly gates, you go in, just and you're like, I'm finally going to figure out what this is all about and be like, holy crap, he's a God's huge a piano. He's a baby grand.
Well, it'd be like that scene from Goonies. You have to play the right notes or else you fall down.
Right to hell, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I flunked out of piano theory my freshman year of college, so I guess I'm going to hell.
Just fake it, man. Just fake it till you make it.
And the devil is a flying V guitar.
Wouldn't that more so be, I think the devil would be an SG, personally.
Probably, yeah. Probably.
Well, it's not Johnny Cash's Cry, Cry, Cry.
Cry, cry, cry.
But it is the Smashing Pumpkins' Try, 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 version one.
Down a buzz like you said. It's
try version one or version I or alternate or version one alternate mix or alternate take. We had kind of mentioned this before in our Machina episode, but it says that the alternate version is a more sparse version of the song, orchestrated on acoustic guitar with a repeating keyboard part, as opposed to the piano, synth, and electric guitar heavy Machina version. Has studio banter and alternate lyrics. Alan, what is your take on this version of Try, Try, Try?
I remember you guys were saying that it's kind of reminiscent of a Cars song, like maybe mm-hmm. something like. And I do think with that, the doo-doo-doo-doo, that keyboard riff, it is definitely in there. I would say definitively that I do prefer the Machina 1 version mm-hmm. Because it just has a completely different character to it. Mm-hmm. This one does feel like it is kind of, like we've been talking about, different things that the Machina stuff does in terms of harkening back to previous Pumpkins output. I do feel like the drum part that's in this song sounds sort of 1979-esque.
I was going to mm-hmm. say that, yeah.
Yeah, and so it does start to conjure that same sort of nostalgic feeling. And especially, I like anytime Billy during this period references things like Pop-Tarts or Cherry Cola yeah. and stuff like that, because it really does speak to that sort of, and he's talked about this, especially ever since he went vegan, about how, you know, his diet was very much a kid growing up in Chicago. It was pizza and hot dogs and stuff like that. So you get this sort of like this feeling of humble beginnings and an awareness, mm-hmm. you know, because when some people write lyrics, it's almost like it's in a vacuum. You know, you can kind of put it in its own little box and it's not attached to anything else. But I do feel like having a reference like that in this song takes on the dual meaning, of course, of the breakfast toaster pastry, but it's also, you know, a Pop-Tart. You know, what was Billy talking about in that last interview with Tammy Heidi or whatever about the Britneys of the world? And that yeah. was tongue in cheek. Mm-hmm. But like, I do feel like it is sort of, you know, again, just like Slow Down is about like, what do I do next? I got to just keep moving. Mm-hmm. You know, this song is very much still in that the try, try, try aspect of it is about, you know, even though it seems like the odds are insurmountable, we're going to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like we said before, like I kind of like that. It's so funny that you mentioned 1979 because this time when I was listening to it, I was like, oh, this feels like such an 80s throwback. Mm-hmm. And I bet if they recorded it like they did 1979 and they released it as a single, it would have been a mm-hmm. pretty, I think it probably would have done better than perfect. But I like mm-hmm. the way that they recorded it for Machina. It has a quirk to it that I really like. I wouldn't say I prefer it. I almost ride that line just because of its quirkiness.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking about its potential, mm-hmm. I think I like the idea of like its potential and how it's quirky yeah. versus the album version. But I do like the album version and how they did it. And the lyrics, the alt lyrics on this are really cool. Like, I mean, just like from Houston on a downer buzz. Like, it's such a fun...
Such a good line. I misheard that, and I
thought it was bus.
I thought yeah. it was bus, too. From Houston, on a downer bus, like you said. And then I started thinking about our interview with Peter McAbish, who was talking about touring with them on the Arising Tour, and there were two buses, the bus that Billy and Jimmy shared, and then the bus that James and Darcy shared, which was known as the Fun Bus. So then I heard this line, I was listening to this, and I was like, holy shit. Billy is describing being self-aware of like being on the downer bus, going from city to city. Either way, it's a great lyric. The lyrics in this version really, really grew on me. This version really grew on me. And there's almost something... The kind of pluckiness or poppiness of it almost makes it sadder, you know? It's like the yeah. song is trying to be a... Yeah, it's like trying its hardest to be a happy song, but there's so much sadness in it.
Yeah, the lyrics, it pours down the back of the bitter sun, desperate for love, and loves everyone in my mother's arms, no simple harm.
So, yeah, whoa. I love that. I love that whole section.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got a quirky... you know, feel to it. And I kind of love the potential of the song, but I do really like the album version of this. But it's a cool little demo to have on here. It's a cool little like alt take that it really I love about the Pumpkins, when they can have like different takes on a song. And you're like, whoa, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. How it kind of shifted to this or that. And especially during the Machina era, it's really kind of, there's a lot of that.
Yeah. And something about this song, maybe I'm wrong, but this kind of feels like it's, like if you point to the song, you could kind of say like, oh, this is definitely like a cross section of Billy's and James's sensibilities musically.
Yeah. Yeah, especially that kind of pop, indie pop sensibility
totally,
that James had at
yeah.
that time with scratchy records and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that influence because of Fountains of Wayne-y, Fountains of
absolutely.
Wayne keyboard part. Yeah.
Yeah, there is, I don't know. Actually, I didn't think about that. Even the drum part, we mentioned 1979, but then thinking about the James songs that are on the 1979 single, there is sort of a passing resemblance in terms of the sort of straightforward four on the floor beat that's in The Boy, as well as this. So yeah, they're different tempos, different vibes, but there's a similarity there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, right now I'm reading off of a lightweight titanium laptop, but right now we're going to be talking about a heavy metal machine. Machine version 1, alternate mix or version I, alternate mix or alternate take, has alternative lyrics and used a lot as the bed music in the Glass animated shorts. Conrad XX or Conrad X on Genius.com posts, the extreme fuzz effect on the guitar tracks and the disjointed and distorted vocal tracks convey the insanity of Glass, the lead character telling a story in the three-part concept album. Alan, your thoughts on this version of Heavy Metal Machine?
To be perfectly frank, Frank,
thank you.
I this was one of those ones that I would usually skip. For the simple fact that I really do enjoy the Machina 1 version. I love how huge the riffs are. I mean, yeah, the lyrics are cynical and dark and whatever else, but when it opens up to that major part with the Let Me Die for Rock and Roll stuff, like it just gets me every time. But then with this version, what we talked about earlier with the Adore and Judaso version of Saturnine. It almost reminds me of like the Ransom soundtrack stuff that Billy did. He's playing around with these sort of Skinny Puppy-esque industrial sounds.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like the vocals are a little bit too buried and it doesn't have the same punch as the main version of the song, or at least the album release version of the song. So I'm not going to say I completely pan it, but it's not like, even I listened to it two or three times in the last couple of weeks building up to us doing this. And I still just, I love a lot of the industrial metal and industrial rock stuff that was happening in the mid to late 90s. But it just, it feels almost a little bit like filler to me. Like, he's just like, the band's just figuring out what the song is, and it's not until it takes on these other permutations that it really becomes something.
Yeah, it definitely feels more like a kind of the way it served in the animated series that they did for this. I think that it does serve more as like a score, mm-hmm. you know, rather than an actual song. But yeah, the industrial elements are undeniable. And I wrote down, it's like a kaiju tearing through the ocean or something, just like at a slow pace. But I even wrote down, because I had this visual, this weird visual for some reason, of Billy being swallowed up by like concrete in the earth. And he slowly gets to be led up to sing, but it's a zombie Corgan.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of robotic the way that he sings.
Totally.
And it's like kind of very, and it even does this like weird robotic monotone thing where it cuts out, you know, a few times. It gets kind of... Did you notice that the guitar sound, that it sounds like Destination Unknown? That harmonica-like guitar sound that's on Destination Unknown?
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that?
Yeah. Well, now that you mentioned it.
Pat, did you notice it?
I totally...
Did you notice it, Pat?
I totally can notice it now.
Okay, great.
I have to say, I like this version. I don't know why. It's because it's so hard to pin down. It's so... The fact that I think I Heavy Metal Machine, the regular version on Machina 1, was kind of the one that I would skip the most. I think I didn't... I was put off by it and for various reasons. Or not reasons I didn't even understand, but... which I have warmed up to and appreciate now, but... There's something about this that is so the vocals and the instrumentation are so distorted to the point of sounding almost like you guys remember like in a regular Nintendo, regular NES game where like Blades of Steel is one of that where they would like there would be like a brief moment of like, because you couldn't like talk in a lot of those games,
right.
Not, you know, like
very clipped.
But when they would like go out on a limb and have like
Blades of Steel,
like it sounded like it, like this is what that song sounds like to me. And I do give it credit for like for it's singing, it's, you know, it's talking about a heavy metal machine, and it's not necessarily in like a purely heavy metal style either. It's almost like this is like Billy's version of like Sonic Youth, like noise experimentation, but it's still called Heavy Metal Machine, you know.
I wonder if that's a conscious decision in terms of like maybe thinking about like Lou Reed's album Metal.
Yeah.
And how that's not a metal album, right. But it is like a noise experiment album.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this, I guess the thing is that all that having it be like a soundtrack score, let alone being noise experimentation and stuff, that makes a lot of sense. But I think when it's paired with these other songs that are very much songs, mm-hmm. you know, it's an odd juxtaposition. And I think that's probably what put me off to the song for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. This EP, when you look at it as a single unit, like, these three songs are all
it's a weird one. Yeah.
It's a weird one. Yeah. They don't, they're all counter, but they're all versions of songs, and they don't feel really related to each other that much.
Yeah. And the only kind of alt lyrics on here is there's one part that says, could you long to love? Could you want to see coming down below, coming down for me? And then even one part of another that's slightly different is like, will you write my songs, will you shake the hands, mm-hmm. you know. So like there's like slight variations on it, but it's kind of interesting like how those changes were made. Am I crazy, Pat and Alan, Does it go into Lucky 13 at one point? Because it sounds like it shifts on that, like, you are so fucked part from Lucky 13.
Mm-hmm.
There's, it sounds like the same part of that. Dun, 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 dun.
Maybe.
Because usually in the regular Heavy Metal Machine, it goes into the, like, that let me go, you know.
Yeah.
And this one kind of goes deeper down.
Right.
It almost
right.
sounds like Lucky 13.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of like playing with motifs on this record. I think like certain elements, whether it's lyrical or whether it's actually musical. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was, because actually, speaking of lyrical motifs, that first alternate set of lyrics that you read echoes, you know, the chorus from "Stand Inside Your Love."
Right.
So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was sort of like a hodgepodge of related ideas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the weird drum flange at the end, like the way it kind of sounds and the way it kind of the delay trails off. It's just so weird. It's got such a weird ending, but I totally. Kind of like it. I'm not mad at this variation. It's not my favorite, but it is very interesting. It's like a nice little, again, like it's cool to hear. It's
right.
Cool
it's like
have.
If I had to choose five Pumpkin songs to listen to for the rest of my life, I don't think this would be one of them. But since we're diving this deep into this trove of songs, like it is a fun, weird stop along the way. And weird aspect of the hodgepodge that is Machina too.
Cool. Well, that is the Machina 2 EPs. One thing that we wanted to bring up, especially with having you here, Alan, being an illustrator yourself, we wanted to talk about the artwork, because we didn't get to get into the artwork of Machina 2 in our last episode that we did covering the proper Machina 2. So, Pat, kick us off on some of the information about the artwork.
Well, the artwork, and there's not a ton of documentation out there about this, but the black and white artwork for the official Machina 2 release was done by designer Carlos Segura. I managed to find it on his website, or his sort of company's website. A lot of people out there were saying that Billy did the design the artwork himself. I don't think that's true. I believe it was done by Carlos Segura. And then there are the you know, the EP covers, which are all slightly different variations on these kind of repeating symbols. It's very bootleggable. Black and white printer will do the job, you know. But I didn't really engage. I remember this, but I didn't really engage with it because I had my like eBay promo CD, which was using the like a plate from the Machina 1 album liner notes, and sort of using that same treatment to like the track list and stuff. So I always like experienced this in the sort of same brown colors as the as Machina 1. But
speaking of that, something we didn't mention about the Machina 1 packaging.
Oh right,
yeah, it won a Grammy, or no, it didn't win, it had a Grammy nomination
right.
in the category of best album packaging.
Yeah. And so there you go.
Yeah, so Alan, what are your thoughts on the artwork for this, or even Machina in general, this whole era?
I think the stuff that Vasily did for the first one, you know, it's very much like, I think the artwork between these two releases is very much indicative of what they are. Like, where the artwork and the music is very much produced, and again, the word I keep using today is grand. This one takes on the vibe of, you know, something that, you know, it's a lot more DIY feeling. And it actually, the aesthetic of it kind of reminds me of the early Joy Division stuff, like in terms of not so much like Closer or Unknown Pleasures or anything like that, but like the stuff that was released by on Factory, I think, And that stuff had, you know, a lot of like propaganda style imagery and stuff like this. I think with the Machina 2 stuff, because there was a lot of merch actually that came out that was Machina 2 themed. I remember there were the two little cartoon characters.
Yeah, I wanted that shirt so bad and I never got it. Yeah.
And that one had the Gottmog font that was very very ornate. It looked almost like a Star Wars-esque kind of language.
Yeah.
And I feel like I really loved that period. I thought all that stuff looked really cool. And there were little almost like clip art style images of like cassette tapes and stuff like that. I liked that stuff. I think the minimalism of the look of Machina 2, especially the black and white symbols that look like they're going on infinitely, I feel like that is sort of indicative of the sort of approach that a lot of later, you know, post 2007 Pumpkins art would take on as well. Mm-hmm. I think about, you know, the Art Deco of Shining Oh So Bright and Seer and stuff like that. They are these really interesting images, but they are really sparse in comparison to something like the Melancholy liner notes or Machina 1 or something like that. So I do feel like it shows what I like about the Machina 2 art is it's made to be easily shareable, which was the idea at the time, but it's also very, for a band that prides itself on going big or going home, it's very minimalistic and it just shows a different side of the band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really like the artwork for this, like, because of its simplicity. And I always love those little two mascots or icons.
Yeah, I've been thinking about a t-shirt for that and how much I would love to have that shirt.
I wouldn't be surprised with all the reprints of all the Gish and
yeah.
Siamese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't be surprised if we got those from the Zuzu's reissue. Or the store. Yeah, like,
yeah absolutely. So. Well, if they do, I'm buying that shirt immediately, even though I have way too many of these reprints or these new prints. Oh boy, the money I'm spending.
Yeah, but you're gonna be fixed for shirts for life.
Right. You're gonna be in an old folks home with people with sleeve tattoos.
Yeah.
And you'll have like a pumpkin shirt that's basically new because you wore it three times because you've been wearing all the old
right.
ones.
Right. Exactly.
From when you're a
teenager. In a way, you're saving money on shirts in the long run.
Yeah. Like, hey, take a look at this. I've got the silver edition of the Viper Room vinyl. Yeah,
anyone?
Right, and it's like that meme where like the person's like, "Sure, Grandpa."
Yeah,
sure you do. It's the Viper Room.
Well, Pat, this concludes our coverage of Machina.
Whew.
This concludes Machina Summer. Except we're gonna have a fan, you know, appreciation episode as always, as we do with the post Melancholy albums. But wow, what a ride!
What a crazy summer. We said we were gonna lose our virginities and listen to all of Machina this summer, and
we did one of those.
We did one of those things.
And you managed to, with all the kaiju references, it's like you ran through a real estate meeting in a Godzilla suit while smoking a cigar.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Wait, which Cusack movie is that? That was the one after Better Off Dead.
That was One Crazy Summer?
Yeah.
One
Crazy Machina Summer.
One Crazy Summer it's been. Yeah, and I mean, movie. In a way, you know, Machina Summer never ends. It's not going to be the last time we talk about Machina, obviously. The whole theme of this is it's an unfinished work.
Ooh.
And then there's you know.
We have like 80 songs to cover or whatever when it finally comes out. Well, that's going to be a massive task.
Yeah, but I feel primed to do it now. Like, now that we've thoroughly digested the whole of what's out there, you know, currently, I feel like we're ready for when this thing gets reconfigured into something resembling what it was meant to look like at the outset.
So Alan, thank you for helping us land this mammoth.
Yeah
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, thank you guys for having me. I would say the great thing about your podcast, guys, is that for people who are just getting into the band, or people like me who've been into the band, you know, for 20-something years, is that it does help to rekindle and reinvigorate that passion.
Mm-hmm.
And it also pulls into sharp focus the fact of how, because it's the same, mostly the same people behind the music, how the interconnectivity of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because now I'm thinking about the lines in the two different versions of Speed Kills, and now I'm thinking about My Love is Winter off of Oceania. Mm-hmm, right. And now I'm probably just going to have to put together a playlist. So yeah, that's the magic. That's the magic of Smashing Pumpcast.
Thank you, man. Yeah, for us too. I mean, it gets us in the same mode in a way that we wouldn't be, you know, be otherwise. So
yeah, it really just solidified like how much I'm like, oh, this is my band.
Yeah.
Like revisiting this and having the themes and being invested in it, just being like, wow. Like, I mean, I have bands that I'm just absolutely, you know, just way into, like The Cure and, you mm-hmm. know, Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that. But like this, yesterday I was just thinking this too, preparing for this episode, being like, this is going to sound crazy,
but if I'm insane,
it really does feel like there's a reason why I'm into this band, or they like mm-hmm. speak to me so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason why it just like really, really, I don't know, it just feels like, oh, this is my band.
Yeah, this is the only band I could do this with, and it's rewarding on many levels because it's like, it's kind of figuring out yourself at the time when you, what, like, unraveling what connected you to this at a time when it was just, like, on a gut level, you know? And also, I don't know, just reveling in, like, this, like, these artists with, like, a crazy huge body of work that came out fast and furious, and almost in a way where, like, there wasn't even time to digest it all in real time. You know, there was like too much stuff in that first decade of their existence to like really see the entirety of it. So it's been great. So this kind of does, I mean, we're going to talk about Judas O disc. We're going to talk about the greatest
still
hits.
Becoming Apart.
We probably won't do that till later. We'll circle back to that one, but
we'll definitely
talk about Rotten Apples,
Judas
O, and then the final Metro show.
Yeah, so there are still more official releases that we're going to talk about, but this is kind of, you know, this is the last album, and it was a crazy album it was.
Yeah, that closes the door on the 90s pumpkins, mm-hmm. End of an era.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, and you know, it's a good note to end it on, but I think, you know, the boomers had the Beatles, and I remember in the 90s when like the anthologies came out and there were the documentaries on TV mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I remember thinking like, wow, I wonder if I'm ever going to be as into a band as people are into the Beatles. And there are only a handful of bands that people really, and musical artists in general, that people really do deep dives. And I think the Pumpkins are going to be one of those bands that once we can get past the sort of smearing of the legacy and just see it for what it is, which is what this podcast is, you know, getting past all that bullshit. The band is going to be remembered differently, I hope, in like the next 50 years than what we've been dealing with for like the last 20. So,
And so
at the end of the day, I think that's an interesting idea, Pat, that you just brought up, that like, it's about trying to understand who you were when you were like 13 or 14
mm-hmm.
from the perspective of somebody in their 30s or 40s.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I think it's not just nostalgia. And I think at the same time, this was the last era where people were avidly looking for this, where people mm-hmm. were avidly looking to dive into albums and read the liner notes and stuff like that, because the industry has basically done away with that because we've moved away from that in so many other respects.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, whatever replaces the experiences that we're talking about, which I'm sure there are kids that like lose themselves in, you know, YouTube and Wikipedia holes researching stuff they mm-hmm. like, you know? But I really hope that people do get to have these same types of experiences with not just the Pumpkins, but with other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it sucks that we're so disconnected from music meaning what it did. And I don't want to sound like, oh, I'm an elder millennial and things were different back mm-hmm. then. But at the same time, it does feel like I really wish we can get away from music just as a background soundtrack.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I feel like I personally went through a period I think it coincided with probably being broke, being focused on other things, but also the death of physical media being the way to experience music. And it was that window between when I was collecting CDs and when I started collecting vinyl again. And I, like, when I finally resumed, like, kind of collecting music again, it was like a piece of myself kind of came back that I had put away for a while, you know?
Same, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's been through the journey from file sharing to MP3 players to smartphones to streaming. Like, there's a lot of stuff that got lost in the mix, mm-hmm. where the thing that made me start buying vinyl and easing off on CDs, but more so buying vinyl and sometimes cassettes, was that it's a celebration of the amount of effort that goes into it. I was in a band for a number of years, and so much of what you do is hardly ever rewarded. The late nights practicing, writing songs, recording, paying out of pocket to do all this stuff, you know, because you're doing it yourself. It just, you know, I would always get mad at friends who would whine that they couldn't make it to a 10 o'clock set because they had work the next day. I was like, what do you think I'm fucking doing, you know? Like, so, and if you want to check that stuff out, the band was called The Terrapin, and there's a lot of, on my end, because I was the guitar player, there's a lot of Pumpkins worship in there. Yeah. So, yeah, nice. So, but again, I mean, you know, not everybody picks up an instrument and wants to rule the world with rock and roll. So it's like, you know, how do people find their way into whatever genre it is now, mm-hmm. you know? There's too much.
Yeah, and well, also please, for everyone out there, do check out Alan's band and also check out Alan's book. I mean, speaking of a piece of physical media that you can be excited to hold in your hand, that's got to feel like a pretty cool accomplishment, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm planning, definitely, if not for a direct sequel, I'm still going to be writing poems and trying to turn them into comics and convincing poetry people and comic book people that their two worlds can be in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I'd appreciate, yeah, if you guys check out the book. You don't necessarily have to check out the band.
Nice. Well, check out well, yes, you do. We're saying yes. We're
all right. Pat says it, so go do it.
You have to do both. But yeah, the book is called When the Pain Starts: Poetry as Sequential Art, and that's exactly what it is. It's a poetry book that reads and looks like a graphic novel, and it works really well. It's great,
and it's
going to be rewarding for, you know, it on its own, but as a Pumpkins fan, that's really baked into it as well, Pumpkins fandom. So yeah. Everybody should check it out.
So Alan, where can people find you, and do you have anything else you want to plug?
The pandemic, you know, obviously hit everybody hard. For a long time, I've out in Long Beach, California, I was hosting a poetry reading series called Poetry Bleeding. I'm hoping that if we don't go into another lockdown and we can get the Delta variant under control, that I will start doing it again. So I think I'm pretty nice. I'm pretty amiable. So if you want to come see me read some of those poems, buy a book and stuff, look for it in the near future. And otherwise, you know, the book is available through the publisher, Moontide Press, or you can get it off of Amazon and help Jeff get his dick rocket back into space.
All right. Oh, so true. Branson, too. Speaking of Virgin, out of here. Oh, literally get out of here, millionaires.
Yes, why don't you stay up there?
Just stay out there. Well, Alan, it's been a pleasure having you on our longest episode. We'll probably have to split this one up because of the anchor, the limits, file limit. But we really appreciated you coming onto the show, and we had a great time. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, man, I totally love to do this again, so let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Pat, any closing thoughts, words?
Yeah, thanks for joining us on Machina Summer, but, you know, the summer never ends, really. You know, school's out forever, and we have a lot more stuff to talk about. So, yeah, hopefully by next summer we'll lose those virginities. But for now, I have no complaints.
All right. Well, until next time,
we wish you all a fond farewell and good night.
Steel.